Welcome to the Randon Podcast with Raffi and Randall.
Welcome and welcome back to the Randon Podcast, which is the podcast that explores how the random affects the everyday.
Yay.
We're here.
You have like canned applause at that point? Is that something?
Oh, shit, yeah.
It rolls in.
I'm trying not to swear.
Hey, you're not supposed to swear.
I swear, I'm just going to just make it not safe for work these days. It's just getting too hard.
Explicit language warning.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, just don't listen to it very loudly. But anyway, yes, canned applause here again and audience cheer. There we go. Today, we are joined by Lahiru, who is one of the other Anithas in my department and also a friend.
Hi, Raffi.
Howdy. Welcome. Yeah.
Though we should make that disclaimer that nothing we say, these opinions are all our own and not of our hospital or our college.
Except for Lahiru, who talks on behalf of my department.
In fact, it's not even our own opinion, really.
No, this is for entertainment purposes only. I believe that is the lawyer talk.
Yeah, like ivermectin, it's just for entertainment, right?
Well, it's true, we did. So Lahiru is also an anaesthetist. We work in the same department in public, but he has a whole bunch of random projects that he's done over the course of time that I've known him, from dance instructing, music, podcast, YouTube. Tried to send a plane to Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you know, the guy is the perfect randint house guest.
Or just epitomize randomness.
Or just a guy with a short attention span. And
yeah, you say that, but your projects go for a lot longer than most of mine ever do.
Oh, thanks.
Just a bit of background on Lahiru. I've known him since I was a registrar, and Lahiru has been doing these medical education courses for anesthetic trainees called the Medical Viva Bootcamp.
Just the Viva Bootcamp. Yeah.
Viva Bootcamp. Yep. Okay. I think you had a Medical Viva one as well.
No, I didn't. No, it's just the Viva Bootcamp. But then the ASA called their Medical Viva one the FANSCA Final Bootcamp, I think. But then that changed. Yeah.
Anyway, it's been courses. That's why I first got to know you. And I think whilst you were on rotation to one of the other hospitals I was working at back in the day. And then I basically didn't see you at all until I started working in the department. And then we've kind of hung out ever since. And somehow, independent of all this, supposedly you, Chandra and Lahiru knew each other, which I actually don't know how you guys know each other. Oh. I don't know if it's like a brown connection thing.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I think I would have met Chandra because I know his other mates in uni. Because I've definitely met him, but I didn't know he was Chandra. I just kept hearing the name because my sister's an ophthal as well, and then I knew you, so I kept hearing about this Chandra who's got all this stuff going on. And then finally, when I met him, oh yeah. I met him like years ago. I met him, was it back in like 2003 or 4?
Yeah, I feel like it's like, kind of cross paths a little bit. And then after finding out, hey, cool dude who does a whole bunch of stuff. And so let's talk more.
But it is funny because you both are like my advisor on so many different things. You know, Raffy's always working, but I used to go for a jog and then go, hey, Raffy, he lives in South Bank. Raffy, are you available? Raffy's not, but he's working. Chandra's available. Yeah, let's go for a coffee and I'll just debrief and ask him advice about what I need to do. So
the best part about being unemployed is good. Are you free to come for a coffee? Yes, I am. In fact, I'm already there.
But I think that therein lies Lahiru's problem. He's getting advice from us.
it's gone all right. I mean, the secret really is nothing that I do, it can all fail and it doesn't matter. Like it's just shits and giggles.
So
I think part of it is you've got to enjoy doing it as well. So it's kind of like, it's a win-win either way, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So I used to love it where Lahiru was like, he was doing the podcast and he'd ask about some audio sort of technical stuff. And I'm like, this may be that. We hadn't started our podcast back then. And then I was like, I should ask Lahiru and get some tips. And so his first question was, so what's your podcast about? And I distinctly remember going, nothing. It's kind of random. He's like, what are you trying to do with it? I'm like, we haven't quite figured that out yet.
We've just decided there's a podcast.
Yeah. Hey, that's the first step. Progress, not perfection, right? You have no idea what you want to do. You just know that you want to put something out there that maybe someone might be interested in. And the world's a big place. So chances are, even if you've got 99% trolls, at least a couple of maybe 0.1% of people, it might make a difference to.
Well, one person
we might change the lives of some trolls. We'll be happy with that.
That's right.
Well, I think I had to rope Chandra in by just saying, hey, let's just order dinner on Uber Eats and just on the first episode.
But you know, like I say, if you're getting trolls, that's a sign that you're succeeding because
then we are succeeding. We are.
Yeah.
We have a troll listening metric. That's like one of our KPIs.
Oh, nice one. I've tended now to, you know, screenshot all the trolls and got them in a folder because they're almost like a badge of honor. And they're really funny. Like one person, you know, there's an IV cannulation video where I'm doing like a back of the wrist cannulation, which are pretty difficult, but sometimes
it's on YouTube.
Oh, is that sorry?
We'll link on the podcast show notes and like many, many projects. And because he's now, 150% increase in his Patreon subscribers, we've got to put that in there too.
Oh, yeah, we'll put your Patreon link there. But yeah, you're saying, have you gotten any of your trolls on Patreon?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm demonstrating the difficult cannulation technique in the back of the wrist, you know, spindly veins, really difficult. And this one person goes, who is this effing guy? Even the ward boys in India could do that. And I was like, that's a pretty harsh troll, but it's pretty funny as well. I'm pretty happy to get that. And also, I want to offer that ward boy a job. He should be the cannulation expert for all hospitals. Just walk.
Yeah, please come.
Well, I mean, I think it should be a challenge, right? It's like, come on, I want to see, like, if it's genuinely true. I want to see his cancellation video, genuinely.
Absolutely.
Like, if you can do that easily. I had to call Josh, one of our other friends in the other day. I literally spent an hour doing an endoscopy list and I could not, with ultrasound, find anything. Probably the first time where I've just gone like, yep, that's an hour. I really got to call someone out. Josh comes in and he's like, done.
This sounds like the perfect segue to say, so it sounds like you like teaching people.
Yeah, no, I really do.
A minute and a half to go on this first bit, but I was keeping an eye on it.
Yep. But yes, it sounds like the medical education is something that you're into.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things that feels effortless. I enjoy it. It doesn't take too much. No, it does take a lot of time, sorry. But I don't have to, I don't feel like I'm doing much. It's not much effort to do it. So, you know, like people end up doing what the natural thing of what they do is. And yeah, I think teaching's just really exciting for me and yeah, just enjoyable.
Okay. With the teaching, like how did you actually stumble into it? Like, I'm assuming you didn't like just start one day going, hey, yeah, teaching is like the thing that I just,
yeah,
it was least need to do. How did you actually come to that point?
I think the interesting thing is, so when you're a junior, there's not many opportunities to teach. You're trying to pass your exams, you're learning. As soon as I passed my exams, I thought, there's a few algorithms in my head. There's a few processes that aren't really taught. Why don't I do some 7 a.m. lectures for anyone who wants to come along? So I was doing that, and that slowly became the content. So then that became the content for the intro to anesthesia course, the ABCs of anesthesia course. And so that was one thing that happened. And then
I'm assuming these are like having done it. So it's a bit of a leading question. It wasn't the, you know, this is anesthesia exams 101. Here's the content. What were the algorithms that you were wanting to teach?
Yeah. Okay. So that was the intro to anesthesia course. So think basic things that you may not have learned in your first few months of anesthesia, but let's say the exam course that you went to, you know, the part two exam was just really, it felt like it was a bit of a language game. It's just a really complex technical challenge to be able to communicate stuff in the way the examiners want it. And the college isn't always completely transparent necessarily about the answers they want. And it's all kind of who you've met and who's told this, the rumors about this and the way to present stuff. So that became, I wasn't a natural at this exam. I think this exam is all about finding the critical issue in a situation. And so why don't I make a whole course based on just drilling that concept? Because it's definitely required in the exam. It's not obviously or transparently told in black and white. And so that just became a course because it was something that wasn't being taught. So, you know, if you have a process or you have something that you think is valuable and no one is really teaching it, that's a gap to be filled. And then secondarily, what's really interesting, so this was the private space, you know, I'm not working in a hospital doing this. There's a lot of accountability. If you run something in a private way, if you're great or if you're good, people will come back and they'll pay money for it. And if you're not good, hopefully you'll realize that because people aren't voting with their feet and they're not paying you, and then and your course is slowly dying out. So you really know your value and you have to keep it at a certain standard. So yeah, I think those elements make it a really interesting space.
Sounds like sort of course was the first thing you did.
Yeah.
Was there a particular reason you chose courses as your first thing?
Courses. It just happened that we wanted to, in our private group, we wanted to run a day course in like a Viva, like just a Viva session. But at that point I thought, oh, everyone runs Viva sessions. I've got these theories of the exam. Why don't I use the theories of the exam as a content and then do a few practice Vivas afterwards? I thought, you know, teach a person to fish and then we'll give you some fishing as well. And then slowly that became bigger and bigger until lockdowns occurred. And then suddenly I couldn't have my 20 to 50 people in a room anymore. But that was accidentally the best thing that happened, because then Zoom allows, like, my biggest course now, I think I have about 170 people in it. And that's because, before people would occasionally come from New South Wales or Perth or Adelaide or Brisbane or whatever. But now everyone just... That was only a handful of people. Now there's generally lots of people. Most trainees around Australia sitting the exam can just log in, and it's a very low bar to entry now.
And do you think that transition, that was kind of like a natural transition that you reckon you would have made? Or
not at all.
Do you think it was kind of like, you know, forced transition as for most people these days?
Yeah, it's definitely forced, and it's definitely a good thing. So, we're probably going to talk about it, but the fact that before all of lockdown and COVID, I had lots of hobbies outside of education. You know, I could go traveling. I could do other social stuff. And lockdown has forced me to say, well, I can't really do all those things. I can still have a limited social life, but I've got so much extra time now. And now I can run courses effectively with a national to international audience on Zoom. This is really interesting. And, I was forced to do it, and it just happens to be a really lucky situation.
Random question. Talking about their YouTube as well. I'm sorry, Rafi, do you have something?
No, I was just going to say, so I would say one of the random questions I just thought of was, a lot of people have similar sort of things, but like I personally will get a lot of imposter syndrome. Like when you're talking about the little genesis of how things came about, I'd be like, someone else can do it better, or like, you know, what makes me qualified to do it? Like, did you ever get that as a...
Every time I run it, I think, I taught this last year. Everyone's going to know this. I'm going to be a fraud. And I definitely feel that. But one of the things I did initially I always run things for free, just because I don't really care about the money, but I'd like people to see the material. And if it's terrible, then, you know, that's fine. You'll probably hear about it. And then when I started charging, that was really uncomfortable, because it wasn't something I was comfortable doing. But then the feedback, the really good feedback, I felt like it was exceptional feedback that surprised me, meant that I felt that the value is okay. And then just things like, you know, if anyone ever says they're not happy, you ask for a refund, I don't care, just, you know, take your money. I apologize for giving you a bad product, but that's never happened. So over time, I've got more confidence that whatever I'm giving, it comes with all the guarantees. I don't want your money if you don't like the content, and that's fine. But I mean, lately it's been a thing where, you know, all the money I take will go to charity. So it feels even far less risky for me, just from that one specific aspect, that, you know, either way you're donating to a charity, all of this income is going to charity, not even just for profit. So, you know, really, I don't feel too bad. Every time, I don't know if the imposter syndrome is ever going to go away. It's probably not a bad thing.
What about the very first one? Because, like, I mean, you know, the thing with imposter syndrome is obviously it's not logical. Like, clearly what you're doing, like, man, helped me pass the exam, you know, so kudos for that. The very first time, you're not, like... It's imposter syndrome has that weird way of kind of make you think that whatever you're doing is much more costly than it is. Like, I would, like, say if it were me and I thought I had something interesting to teach, I'd be like, oh, 7 a.m., no one's gonna wake up that early to want to come to my thing. I'll waste their time for an hour or whatever it is, right? So I would come up with this sort of stuff. Like, how did you actually, like, what was the thing that you made you go, man, I need to do this? Even if it is, like, how did you get over that first? Because that's usually the critical thing, right? Because how many shots you don't take is usually just the fact that you built something up to be much bigger than it is. Do you remember what happened on that one?
Yeah. I don't even think I thought about it. It would have been something like, I think this is valuable. I've passed my exam and, I did well in my exam. Therefore, people might want to hear this. And then I knew all the juniors who wanted to come to those morning shoots, and you'd always get a handful coming and saying that's useful. And then I believed in it. So I think I believed in it. I had the relationships. So it wasn't strangers. And there was a low bar to entry, as in I just had to turn up around the time I'd normally turn up, maybe a bit earlier, and then collect some stuff. And what I've realized now, 10 years later is that, oh, that was just my testing the market. I didn't even realize it was testing the market. It's the proof of concept, and it was in a safe space that I didn't feel too bad. So, in any other circumstance, imagine if you had colleagues and people that believed in you or knew that your intentions were good, and you gave it to them for free, and you didn't have to do too much to show them stuff. I feel like that's how you make it okay, because otherwise the opposite of that would be, I've never done teaching. I'm just going to put something out on Udemy or Udemy or YouTube, charge $200 for it. That would be very, incongruent with feeling good. That would feel uncomfortable for me now, even.
I think one of the things, like, I think the thing that your template's done is kind of like, you've done what the basics of testing the market is, but not only that, you've built up, like, viral marketing and word of mouth built into it. Because if you think about it, it's what you're describing is you have this thing, and you're giving it away for free, but you already kind of know the target market, which is the next bunch of people.
Yes.
And because they're your friends, you've just lowered your barrier to entry. It's like, basically you're going, hey, I've got some tips. I can tell you one by one. So it's kind of like, you're doing them a favor. And that's become the, like, as in, like, when you describe it, I'm like, it seems so obvious.
Yes. But
that would be like, as in, I'm just thinking about going, man, if I have imposter syndrome, I'm going to start all projects with just going, kind of like the jigsaw puzzle thing from, like, last year, right?
Yes.
Like, it only happened because it was everyone in the department, like, someone in the department actually requested it and then spread it around everywhere. And then I was like, oh, looks like I'm making jigsaw puzzles then.
Yeah.
I had no idea how to do it. But, like, actually involving, because I think so many people have side hustles, but they think, like, they can't involve friends or family. Like, it has to be random strangers. But it's almost like you need it to make sure that you've got something of value. Like, yes, some people are going to say yes because they're friends. But if you start getting other people involved, then there's an actual market.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I never advertised it at the start in any way, because that felt, again, I don't think this is reasonable for most people, but for me, I just felt weird to advertise something just in case it was terrible. So it's better that if someone really believed in it, they just, the email list from the previous year is the word of mouth for the next year. That's it. I mean, these days, now there's Instagram and YouTube, and that makes it bigger, and people in ASCA do promote this as well, so that's quite nice. But yeah, when you're starting out, it would be very tricky. I wouldn't even say that. I think maybe we're just being too cautious. We're medical, we're cautious, we're imposter syndrome. But, I'm sure if people did that and just put something out there still is probably less risk than what we feel there is.
Well, I mean,
I suppose one thing is, you highlighted before as well about when you went to actually charge the first people for it. Because I remember, for example, with startup things, where the first time I actually charged for product, that was quite, it was a bit of a up and down, because essentially I was also, pre-selling a product that was to be built shortly and taking pre-sales and actually getting credit card, saying would people pay for it and getting payment up front. And I remember for that, it was a big part of that imposter syndrome of, this better actually work.
Yeah.
But then also it's a step up from, can you give this a try to, now, money is being changed hand, and it felt very different. What about for you, sort of, when you obviously you built up a bit of proof for yourself that, yeah, this is, you know, people give you good feedback from the free one. But when you went to the paid version?
Yeah, that felt, I just looked at courses that were already running and how much they were charging. And I thought, and I pretty much just halved it and thought that's about the right price, but I'm just a solo act. But then, I mean, to be honest, maybe I was short selling myself that maybe I should have just charged at the normal rate of a medical course that goes for a day. And maybe it was just my own fear. But again, yeah, because you're not really, don't care too much about the money side of things, it makes it okay, I think. And I'm not sure how to reconcile it. But yeah, I mean, especially where you did pre-sales, you know, maybe you didn't have the same proof of concept to just, you know, dip your toes in the water. I think that's the next level of confidence, and, you know, then proving that your product is worthwhile through the market being happy with it.
And I guess for you, it sounds like you sort of found, as people are using the course and they're finding it more and more useful, has it become easier to have that as a course set fee?
Yeah. I mean, on Zoom, I wasn't even sure how to price it, but I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go roughly half-ish the value of the in-person course, because that, you know, I'm losing that in-person interactivity. Initially, it was a voluntary donation to a charity.
Oh, yeah.
But then I was just trying to suss out what's the best way I can give a good material but also get the value back for this other charitable project. And I realized that actually just charging the money straight up is far better. On average, I was getting $50, I think, per person through the optional donation model, whereas if I just charge $100 for it, far more people give on average more. So yeah, I think they're happy to. Most of the comments on the Fred Hollis page are very positive. So yeah.
Yay, Fred Hollis. Fred Hollis. Ophthalmology approved.
That's right.
But now that you found that, you know, it's obviously changed with the pandemic and it's become like more scalable, if you like. Where are you going to take it? Like, what does success in this medical education project look like for you?
Yeah, so COVID made me realize, how unequal life is for people, and that made me feel pretty bad about my own luck in life and the luck of the draw. So I thought, okay, well, whatever I do has to be very, very good and charitable, and I don't, you know, I've got a good job. I don't need to make more money. There's nothing necessarily good needs to come out of that. The ultimate aim of this is to get. So now there's a lot of things. You know, a lot of people help me out on the YouTube channel, a couple of podcasts, a website, you know, Instagram, and courses. And so I've got all these people now. I really like the idea of just having people with a similar vision who are happy to work, knowing that they enjoy the projects and they're paid enough in their own jobs. And I guess the win would be to make a substantial dent in a problem. So right now, you know, the last year, I think ABCs of anesthesia made about $50,000. But maybe, you know, 10 years time, maybe that will be, you know, double that, 10 times that, whatever it is. And I like the idea of being able to go, okay, there's a problem, let's solve that problem. So hopefully leveraging.
And you're using you're teaching something to solve, or are you using the money generated to go solve something?
Exactly, using the money generator. So when I think about this, most of the people I teach to pass the exam, they will probably pass the exam anyway. They may have a longer run to it. It might be a bit more hard to figure it out, but I feel like most of them will pass the exam anyway. So essentially, I'm teaching the most privileged, lucky people with, you know, how to pass this exam that potentially they would pass anyway. So, you know, where's the goodness of society? You know, probably not that much goodness of society. But for me to go and work in a third world country potentially isn't the best use of my time. So if I could leverage whatever skills I have in education, make it good quality, so I'm doing what I can do and what I enjoy, and take the benefit of that, which is the monetary gain of that, and divert it into something else, I'm kind of leveraging the fortunateness of myself and other people I'm teaching and our privilege, and sharing it on with something else. So that's the framework that seems to work so far. I have no idea what that's going to look like, but I'm hoping it won't change much.
Is there a big project that you want to like as in you mentioned like congrats on like, you know, it's like year one or two, that's pretty decent revenue from all this stuff. But is there like a, like at the moment it's obviously Fred Hollows, but is there like an ultimate aim? And I'll pretext it by I'm really bad with social media and YouTube and stuff. But like every year during Ramadan, I try and raise money for homeless people. Just as a like, won't go into it too much. But one of the sort of guiding light aims is to have enough money to fund a soup kitchen. There's like a one that hard, like runs on a shoestring budget, but I want to be able to fund it for the year. It's $24,000. Means that that's it. That's their costs done. And I just want to do that once, right? So that's like one of those, maybe it's like one of the motivations, because I don't actually enjoy being in front of the camera that much. So do you have something like that as a metric for what you want to do?
Yeah. So the first metric I had was I just wanted to do something that feels good and feels like it's making a difference. And Fred Hollows was easy. You know, $25 is a lens that's roughly what can give sight to someone. So that felt good. But then I'm sure I've talked to you guys about this, but you know, the effective altruism movement and Toby Ord and William McCaskill and the stuff that they're doing in terms of what is the most effective way of giving money. So there's two things here. I think it's really important to be effective in whatever you're doing. So I feel like I don't necessarily need to have a good idea of whatever my project needs to fund, as long as I give it to someone who knows what they're doing. So potentially, you know, if I could be collaborating with them on a bigger level in the future or someone like that, that would be really good. But also keeping space for the guilty pleasure donations, you know, the stuff that makes you feel good. There's a homeless person who's down the road and you sort out their life for them. I think that would be a massive thing. Or you know, similarly with the soup kitchen, local stuff that makes you feel very good about what you're doing. I think being human, you need to feel good about it, as well as have the, you know, malaria nest to Africa, helping people that you've got no connection with intellectually.
Yeah, I like that balance.
I suppose one thing, you know, you talked a lot about the financial benefits of the project and being able to use that. But are you tracking anything else to kind of determine if it's working the way you want it to work? And it's hard because you're across a whole bunch of different things. So it's like, you know, is it Instagram followers? Is it website views? But or is it, you know, people that have passed the exam?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the one thing that I don't think many people do this in the teaching space, like I'm not really aware, I'm not research heavy, I don't have the skills in that. If I could really get some data on the effectiveness of education and how it is, that would be a really good step. But essentially, I'll be looking for someone who's interested in that, who knows research, who wants to collaborate and do something like that. Because yeah, I just don't have the skills for it. So at the moment, yeah, progress, not perfection. What I'm doing may well not be working, and I don't know. All I've got is, you know, subjective evaluation and feedback and a minimal amount of good positive comment to troll ratio. I think that's all I've got.
Oh, fair enough. I was going to ask you this question a bit later, but I was just wondering... So you've got a whole bunch of things going on, right? Like, so does Chandra. I have my random little projects, but nothing as intensive as that. I always feel like that I never have enough time in the day. Like, I literally, like in the back of the head, always go, I should be doing something else. You seem to find this nice balance of being able to do it with, and as you said, like, you know, lockdowns happened, you felt like you had all this time. Lockdowns happened, and I was like, oh my God, now finally I can catch up on stuff. There's like a difference. Like, how do you actually balance that?
I don't know if I do balance it. I don't know if I do. For example, when I was traveling and having a life outside of work and education, I didn't have that much time for this. So potentially, you know, when lockdown ends, maybe I don't know how much time I might devote to it. Like, I'd like to think that I'd have enough people who want to liaise with me and work with me, and maybe I could take on a role where I get to advise people on doing their own projects with ABCs of anesthesia. But potentially I don't know where that goes. But I think one of those big things is I know that I always feel unsatisfied, like what I'm doing is never enough, and that's not a great feeling to have, because it definitely promotes me working harder and productivity, but that's at the cost of, you know, your mental health as well. If you never think you're good enough, then, you know, what are you doing? You're not being happy. So I think one of my biggest things is to just be content. And so I constantly tell myself, you know, I've got all these things going on, but I just want to be okay. I could lose it all. And, you know, I'm still the same person. So for example, any time someone is going to make a better YouTube channel, a better course, a more popular course, you know, and a better Instagram page and a better website, like everything about this could just disappear.
And of course, then you'd hire a hitman to go after them.
That's what the revenue is for, right? Enough expenses.
Yeah.
Don't F with ABC's of anesthesia. You heard it here first.
We're really threatening you.
He's for death.
So I think I'm okay with, if someone does it better, I can let it all go and just go back to whatever else is interesting and just be completely zen about it. And if I lose time to do something, I will just do as much as I can and try to be content with it. And I think the worst trap for me is to have an ego about it and try to hold on to something if I don't have time or if it's not good or, yeah, not producing what I want.
Have you had to do that in any of your other projects before?
Yes, yeah, so I did start an exam coaching thing for the first part, but that didn't work as well as we wanted to. Like, the model wasn't exactly right. So it's still in process now. There's a few people who are taking more ownership of it, and that might go really well. Like, it's doing pretty well at the moment. Yeah, but there's lots of little, I can't remember any other things that have completely just gone the wayside. It's so far it's gone, things have gone pretty well. But yeah, again, but it's never a complete failure or something. Like, if something doesn't quite work, that's right. I mean, I was trying to do basic life support training for all kind of the senior medical staff, but that didn't have that much take up. You know, there wasn't enough buy-in or necessity that it was happening, that I was necessarily doing that in the way I wanted to do that. So, you know, I do that on a very limited basis now.
I have to catch up with you because I'm due for my ALS training, and I was meant to bug you about this a couple of weeks ago because I missed all the sessions.
Do ophthalmologists have to do this too?
Yeah, look, every ALS medical staff. So.
Random interlude.
With all the side hustles,
yeah.
Do you think that, as compared to, like, you know, obviously we're doctors in our day job, do you think there's still a stigma associated with, like, either good or bad, like, yes, doing other stuff?
Oh, I don't think, like, as long as it's not detracting. Actually, you know what? If your side hustle is a thing that isn't medical-like, or you know, there's a certain stereotype or the culture of what a consultant doctor looks like, and if it doesn't fit that, then probably there'll be stigma attached to that. But all these side hustles are completely, you know, very, you know, congruent with medical stuff. So let's say, you know, you mentioned I was doing some dance instructing. Yeah, I don't really tell many people that I do that, and I don't think I'm very good at it anyway. I'm not some professional dancer, but I think if it doesn't fit with the cultural expectation of a doctor, I definitely think there's stigma. And you can probably imagine
why you don't tell anyone, or is it just like you don't want to tell anyone?
I think I'm probably just a bit shy about it, to be honest.
Like, you're shy. This
no, really. Yeah.
This is an exclusive right here.
It's funny what, you know, I don't seem like a shy person, but I think everyone can be shy about certain parts of their life. And
yeah,
that's definitely one of them. And now it's on a podcast, so whatever.
We'll try and find clips of Lahiru dancing and splice it in here if there's such a thing.
So one of my very first projects, I took a few weeks off. And I just wanted to learn how to set up a website. And I never really learned because I'm just not that good at it. But so me and my mates, whenever our friends get married, we write a wedding song. So we just take a song, change the lyrics. It's very Weird Al Yankovic at a very, you know, mediocre level. But we have so much fun doing it. And, you know, he's a great violinist. I'm an average guitarist. We make lyrics that are meant for the couple. And, you know, it's a captive audience. They enjoy the in-jerks. The couple loves it. And it's just so much fun that, you know, it's a week to 2 weeks of us just getting together, writing out these lyrics and then practicing it and performing it at the wedding. And I thought, oh, why don't I make a website? Because all my mates are pretty much married now. I still want to do this. So I made this website called lyricalgifts.com, and that was like my first foray into, hey, if people want a wedding song, they can, you know, they can commission us and we'll go and do this. So one person has contacted us to do it. That was my personal trainer, and I helped him with a song for free. So it's completely died. No one cares about this. And now.
It'll be the rebirth.
It's gonna blow up now.
Yeah, it's gonna blow up. But all I want one song a year. That was the goal, and I haven't achieved that. So that's all I got time for, but that'd be fun.
Yeah, fair enough. What about for other people that actually want to do things like, you know, like that, or start something outside their main job? What would you suggest to them?
Good question. You know, if you enjoy it, it's easy because you're already doing it. To make it a thing that, you know, to take that risk of potentially having it not work, it requires you to put it out there in some fashion. The internet's the great equalizer now. So, you know, anyone can set up a Facebook page for free, Instagram page for free, and advertise in that way. The barrier of entry to anything, podcasting, YouTubing, literally, if you've got an iPhone and, you know, you don't even need a microphone, you can be there on iMovie editing something and putting it up for free. So whatever you want to do, because it, you know, it's all about progress and perfection. Look at any YouTuber or any person in any business, they started somewhere and it didn't work very well, and they just kept on making errors and got it better. And those initial errors, I think innately, unforgivable, but those errors at the start or those suboptimal strategies are completely forgivable. And if you look at my first videos or my first courses, you know, there's so much wrong with it. And in 10 years time, I'll hopefully look back and go, what was I doing with that intro? What was that music? That was terrible. Your editing's terrible. Your delivery's all wrong. But, you know, if you look back into your past, you always think that you're pretty bad.
We can definitely empathize with that episode one having yum, yum, yum. Us speaking tends to be a bad life choice for podcasts.
Yeah. But it won't be Oprah anymore. It'll be La Hiru, the new talk show for the masses.
that would be terrible.
I reckon it'd be really good. Hey, if it happens, we want to find this fee for the idea.
you can have 0%. Was it 0% of nothing is not much. So
we demand 5% of nothing. Thank you very much.
But here's the thing, right? Imagine a talk show that's completely incongruent with what I do, right? Like I'm just not that person. So there would be, I wouldn't have the energy. I wouldn't be invested in it. That would fall flat. But, you know, a talk show potentially about education, getting good educators on who like that would be potentially interesting.
Mark too. Yeah, got it.
That's right. Yeah.
So in terms of your day job, right? Has there been something that this is talking about day-to-day anesthetics, right?
Yeah.
That you thought was either going to be a negative for the job, or didn't think it had any application whatsoever, but you found ended up being used quite a lot. And I'll give an example, which is like, I got hired as an anesthetist, but half the time I spend doing IT stuff and doing like the random websites and whatnot, right? Yeah. So did not ever think that was ever going to come into it. But either it couldn't be something from your side hustle or something else you learn that you find that you're using more and more, even though that wasn't what the traditional, you know, when you do the exams, that's not what it prepares you for. Is there anything like that in your?
Yeah, I mean, so not as obvious as that actually, but I was hired for, like, you know, everyone's got a Fanscus, so your clinical anesthesia is not under question, but everyone comes in with an extra role in management, teaching, IT, or some other space. Mine was an educational portfolio, so I just ran with that. So the first thing is I didn't realize how important it is to constantly have registrars that I would be teaching constantly. Like, you know, like if I got a question on social media just about how do you deliver? Do you script? What do you do? What's your process? And I said, oh, look, I've been teaching for 10 years. And then not just that, I'm teaching every time there's a registrar. So I'm already scripting and rehearsing constantly. And so the delivery of a lot of this stuff doesn't need to be rehearsed because I've roughly got it set. So that's one of the massively amazing accidents, having registrars, having people to teach, having medical students, which allow me to do. If I was full-time private, I wouldn't be doing that, would I? So I think that's a great accident.
And the thing with you is that you're actually very good at like documenting it, because I think I asked you about iBlocks and you sent me a document and it's like everything from your script, your formula, how you do it, every single bit. And I was like, holy moly, it's like a textbook. It's like, here you go. Yeah. You can skill up to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where it all starts. So there's always a process. So in med school, I feel like there was maybe five teachers who were exceptional at conveying and communicating their algorithms for whatever it was. So, you know, textbooks, it's hard really, it's not that practical, it's not that clinical, but if you find a process and you can, you know, communicate that well for specific situations, that's amazing. And so modeling my algorithms and processes and communicating that is the method. And so that's one of those things. I've got 1,000 formulas and 1,000 protocols in my head for stuff, especially the rare stuff. Like if I'm not doing too many liver resection anesthesia or anyway, fiber optics, I need that, because how am I going to remember it? I can't rely on my memory. And we've got great little iPhone devices that are smarter than us now. And so that's where the iBlocks come in. I have enough people who want the formula. I'm like, ah, great. Okay. I'm doing this all the time. Let's just document it. And that's where the website came in as well. It's so much more enjoyable now that I go, oh, you want to learn cannulation? Fantastic. Watch this video and then remember the stuff, write down some notes, come in, and now you can try it out. And I can talk, have a higher level discussion about the nuances rather than tell you the basics.
This is literally, I think, one of Chandra's ideas.
Nice.
Do you find, because it sounds like you basically like to systemize stuff and then write it down and have that really there.
Yes.
Do you find you use it outside, you know, medical, because it sounds like you sort of, that's your medical education space, which then applies to anesthesia. Does it apply anywhere else do you find?
Absolutely. Like everything really, whether it's traveling is probably the other big high, multitask, short time frame, potentially high risk venture. So, you know, I pack. I just travel light with a day pack. So being able to know that I've got everything I need for travel for 4 weeks in South America with just a backpack, that's I need a process for that. So, you know, everything from the visas, but all the identity documents, the clothes, the technology,
Is there a packing list?
Yeah, there's a packing list. Nice. Yeah, it's on this other website. it's like the no carry on, sorry, the no check in luggage method. But also,
I believe in that too. Good life choice.
Absolutely, yeah. You don't want to be hanging around waiting for your luggage. You want to get on the plane, get off the plane, and go to whatever fun thing you've organized. But I'd say, for my finances, for my education, for travel, and Not cooking, because I think that's all memorized now. But yeah, that's pretty much the stuff that I've done this for.
Gotcha. Fair enough. So I suppose just moving on a little bit then, with sort of doing the other stuff outside medicine, why do you sort of do that? I mean, are you bored at work? Is it, what is it sort of that drives you to do the other stuff too?
That's a good question. I think I've always been someone who wants to learn something new, wants to, grow and just be better at things and learn about the world. So I think that naturally makes these side projects happen. So I think that's a big one. And one of the other things is, you hopefully live to about 80 years of age around that. Mm-hmm. You've got to occupy your time with something. You might as well do something. But I think also it's always been, I like learning and I just get involved. I remember thinking that one of my superpowers is just getting to advanced beginner at stuff quickly. So that's really enjoyable to just learn something, try to get good at it, and get to an average level, and then move on to try something else. That's always fun.
What tends to happen when you get to that sort of advanced beginner level? Do you start to lose interest at that stage, or?
Yes, I think the things I've just dabbled with, I just lose interest. Like, it's fun and it's something to try out. And I think a lot of people do that, where you just go, I'll try the next thing now. But a few things have stuck. So, the dancing has stuck. Playing guitar is stuck. Medicine is obviously stuck. And then definitely the education, video editing and all that has definitely stuck. I enjoy just learning things, and it's something interesting. But I think more recently, this is a secondary benefit, like, you know, feeling that we are very lucky here. We were raised in Australia, we're doctors, and we have all this kind of useful skills and useful, you know, privileges and abilities to share. I think that would be, you know, to be able to leverage all of these things into something beneficial would be useful, whether you're teaching someone else or sharing with someone else. And actually, you know what? And I think that one of the best things is when you do all these things, you just get to meet lots of people. You're collaborating with them. You're making new friends, and it just feels like a very rich life to have, you know, lots of interests, different friends that you meet, you know, and you meet up with. Yeah, it just feels very enjoyable and rich to be doing that, I think.
Hmm. With that,
one of the problems that I sort of find though with these with lots of projects is that I end up with too many of them, because it's fun to learn new stuff and I'm like, shiny object, I want to go learn that. And then I kind of don't really have time to do anything properly. And do you have some sort of way of picking what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've had a recent strategy. So, you know, family and friends, always very important. Work is very important. So that's the majority of my time. And then the extra time, I've realized that if I really care about getting better at something, I will do focused, you know, missions on that. So if I want to, you know, learn how to make a website, you know, I spent 4 weeks just doing that. Or, you know, I had a gym challenge a couple of years ago. I was like, okay, I'm just training 4 times a week, improving my diet. And so if I was to do, say, 5 different activities and do 5 days a week for a year, I would get to a certain level. But if I divided that into, you know, a year divided by 5 and did one activity and focus on it for each period, I would, you know, jumpstart each of those to a higher level. So I think I tend to do that a little bit. Like, I'll just generally do a bit of everything, but focus on the important stuff. And then if I really want to try to get better at something or get more exposure, then I'll just quit all the other stuff and just focus on that for a focus period. Yeah.
We were talking about this in one of the previous podcasts, which was doing things in series versus in parallel, which the thing being that, yeah, if you try and, because, like, you know, there was the whole period of productivity where people were like, oh, we should multitask, but the amount of time taken to switch from one task to the other eats away. So it's actually like more beneficial to just what you do, like commit to something, one thing for an extended period instead of trying to do 5 things.
Like,
which is interesting. Like, it was literally something I think came out 5 episodes ago we were talking about. I just wanted to ask, like, you mentioned obviously when you're collaborating, it's like a very rich life, right? Like, you're trying out all these things. Is there something you want to see, like, how would you get, say, trainees or other people who, it sounds exhausting from the outset, right? So, like, as in, if you go up to someone and start telling someone your projects, I've actually had this happen. I think I was talking to someone saying what Chandra was up to or someone else was up to, and they're like, wow, that just sounds exhausting, I just want to go and have a break. Like, how would you get someone, because it clearly is interesting, it makes you a much more interesting person, and you obviously get all this breadth of skill. What do you think, either, like, you can either sort of say, like, what do you think a trainee should do, or what do you think people should, like, how should people approach it? Like, what's the little step you reckon?
I personally say don't do it at all. Like, there's no point. Like, it just doesn't matter. So I'd say that in that instance where someone isn't doing it, I don't need them to do it. I don't want them to do it. Unless someone wants to do something, there's no real point of it. I'm not here to, like, I don't think my role is ever to inspire anyone to do anything particularly. I'm not sure if that's always true, but let's just go with that for now. But let's say someone wants to do something, then my piece of advice just before to that person on social media was, just do it. I didn't realize how tricky that is, though. Like, I feel like now it's been long enough that, and I don't fear failure too much, that it's very comfortable for me to do it. But I have noticed when I've encouraged people, just go out and try it on your own. Find out your value. You know, you either fail and you know your worth, or you succeed and you know your worth. It's great, and you learn from your mistakes and all these other cliches. But I think that's just the only piece of advice. You know, you'll do whatever you do, it doesn't matter either way. But if you feel like you want to try something new and have a bit of an adventure, experimenting with something, then yeah, give it a go and don't care if it fails, because you know, who cares?
It kind of ties in with the whole imposter mindset thing, right? Like it's the feel of, it's like the other side of the coin, the fear of failure, where it's kind of like, you know, what if I, even if it's a low stakes, you just want to try a thing, it almost feel like, I'm not going to be good enough, so why bother? But there's, it's like saying, you know, I never want to play a board game because I might never win all the time. But it's like the process is the, is the point of why you're doing it. But it's, it gets harder and harder to remember to see that.
Yeah. And so when you start out, you have no experience. So you fear the lack of experience, the lack of ability. But then as you get older and you've got more potential prestige and you've, you know, you've gone up in the world a little bit, then you fear failure because you don't want your, you know, reputation.
You've got more to lose.
Yeah. So to balance those things, like there's always a reason not to do something. And, but, and like, you know, obviously you guys are painting me in a really, really good light and that's very kind, but like,
no, that's your lighting setup. You showed us before.
That's right. 3-point light fix. Yeah. 3-point lighting. But yeah, there's, if I think of all the things that I've just completely bummed at, it's just, there's just so many, all the competitions I've lost at, all the, yeah. And to think that none of those actually matter now, no one cares about it now. Yeah. And yeah, it's completely, everything that you do is pretty much forgivable. And if you do try something and it fails, it doesn't matter. And who knows, it could become something really fun, really useful. You might meet some interesting people on the way.
Random interlude.
We're going to move into the last little section here. Just some random stuff about yourself. So right. It sounds like you do traveling quite a bit. So yeah. What's your favorite city that you've been to?
Ah, good question. There's a couple of places that I absolutely love. I mean, Tokyo, I love because it's just crazy and busy. And I love Exmouth and that whole area because those are some of my most adventurous. There's a couple of places that I love for the absolute adrenaline rush in the wildlife. So Exmouth is you can swim with whale sharks, tiger sharks, manta rays, and humpbacks. The Galapagos Islands, because it's just, again, effortless viewing of animals. There's turtles swimming up to you, baby seals dancing around you in the water, and everything is amazing there, and you don't have to try. And then Hawaii as well. If you go to Big Island, you can literally go on these tours where you just jump in the water and there's just schools of dolphins and manta rays everywhere. And those are probably my most memorable trips, I'd say. Yeah.
Oh, actually. It's like swimming with wildlife is the favorite city that you've been to.
That's right. Actually, you know what? I'm going to go Florence in Italy. I remember, and for all the reason, like, you know, cities can be really beautiful, but I remember we'd found a karaoke bar and it was just one of those nights where it was such an enjoyable time because this karaoke bar had this, you know, this older guy on a guitar who's running everything. And so whenever you went up there, it wasn't like you were just in that booth singing out to just your mates or no one. This was, he was getting this vibe going that you felt like you were a rock star. And so anyone who went up there had this person, you know, guitaring along with them and the whole crowd was getting into it. I just remember that being one of the most epic experiences, just going randomly into this karaoke bar in Florence. I know that's probably not what most people are expecting. You know.
I hear that's on the tourism banner. Come for the water, stay for the karaoke.
That's right. You know, Eiffel Tower or you know, the pyramids in Egypt or New York. Karaoke bar, and a good night out.
Yeah, rockstar karaoke bar. I feel like this is going to be your next project after the whole YouTube thing. Like you're going to set one up here.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun? Yeah.
You're here first. If podcasts are exclusives.
Yeah, maybe cut that part out and just go with the wildlife in various
Okay, another random question. What's something that other people think is mundane but you really enjoy? And as an example,
easy. IV cannulation. Just love it. Yeah, I mean it's just obviously it's one of those tasks that it's very, you know, it's not a very prestigious thing to be able to do, put an IV in. Let's say it's not a task that many people enjoy, but I just like it. Give me 50 cannulas and I'll enjoy doing that just because, you know, I get into a flow state. So for example, ECT, you know, electroconvulsive shock therapy, you might have you know, anywhere from 5 to 13 patients in the list. And it's one of the few times in life now that I get into a flow state where I'm putting drips in, getting the airway, putting the drugs in, waking up next, rinse, repeat. And, you know, you really matter as an anesthetist. You can do that efficiently, quickly. The drip always goes in every time. It's the difference between, you know, you're staying over until 2 p.m. or finishing at 11. So, yeah, I find that really fun.
And they usually have tricky drips too, because
they're tricky, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's every few days. So it's kind of like the common ones get blown. And
yeah.
They usually have X, Y, and Z other problems.
Yeah.
A lot of have substance abuse stuff. So it's not exactly the easiest.
Yeah. Can I ask you guys, what was your mundane thing that you actually like?
Mine was, so one of the, like, the first house that I bought needed touching up, and you know, I'd never painted anything, like as in just, you know, painted walls or anything before.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh yeah, it's like, it's not that big, so I'm just gonna get a few cans of paint and just do it myself, just to see what it's like. What I forgot was, when the tenant leaves, unless you connect the power, there is no power. And it was the middle of summer. So I, you know, set up all these rags and I started, and it was like, I was just dripping in sweat. Right. And my mom was helping me just because she was doing some other stuff around. And instead of taking a day, it took like a week and a half.
Wow.
of taking leave and just, you know, going to the walls, because everything, like, you know, my technique was crap and you could see the pain coming through. But anyway, we got it done. And she just turned around at the end and she was like, you know, you just looked so like in the zone. And it's true. There's something about, like, it's your flow state thing. After a while, it's just this, you could see the progress. Old color, new color, right? Yeah. And it's just like, there's something almost meditative about it.
Yeah. And there's a few books that mention this guy, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. He talks about flow state. And I think he's the first person to coin that, but also the fact that you're at your happiest in the times you don't think you're at your happiest. So when they've done studies where they ask for point happiness, you know, your happiness that you rate at a very specific time. Most people think that they're happiest at home when they're just, you know, chilled out, resting, watching Netflix or whatever it is. But when people actually rate their happiness, they are most happy when they're motivated, when they're at work, when they're doing something. And yeah, so get me into that state as, you know, many times as I can. So for me now, like as a kid, it's easy. You play sport, you can, you know, bounce a ball against a brick wall for ages. You know, like it's so easy to be in a flow state when you're a kid, but now it really is. It seems video editing, you know, doing this fast operating lists, cataracts and the ECT. And and maybe playing a sport. Like I remember playing Frisbee recently and that was tiring, but fun. Like you realize how unfit you are, but it's just passing, 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 running, passing. It's a beautiful thing.
What about you, Chandra?
Yeah, I mean, flow state wise. Well, it's interesting because when you first said, the little thing is just like clearing my email inbox to zero. Just makes me so satisfied when there's nothing left in my inbox. I'm just like, the day is off to a good start. No, evil 3000. No. Oh, God.
Evil, you've got a lot of work to do after this.
No, I don't have much work to do. I'm going to send it to Chandra and see how he goes.
I must get this to zero.
It'll never happen.
But I can definitely identify with the flow state thing, and cataract list is the best for that because when you're operating, it's just you're focusing on the operation and literally, you know, but when I have proper high volume lists, then I, you know, finish the operation, write my op note, go straight over to, and start scrubbing for the next case.
Yeah.
Walk in and stand, sit there with my prep waiting. As soon as the patient's on the table, prep, do the case. And you just keep going for like, you know, the whole afternoon, round and round.
And it could get better than that. One of the Indian opthals I was talking to in Broome, he talks about how in India, in his hospital, they would do like 80 a day. And it's literally just a patient, just three patients. And you just move the machine to the next one and they move the patient around and bring another one in. And they've done
Sri Lanka as well. I want to watch, and that's what they do. And actually, there's a dude in Japan, one of the really high volume guys. That's what he does as well. And it's just so much more. It would be amazing. I'd love that. Just operate, spin around, keep going.
And no paperwork. Just doing what you love to doing, what you're good at, operating.
Yep.
Yeah.
Should we go with one more random question?
Yeah.
Why not?
All righty. So Okay, we'll go with the last one. So what's a movie or a story or piece of art that you saw that you couldn't think about, stop thinking about long afterwards? So it's not like, you know, you just saw the Avengers and you're like, yeah, cool. There's like, there's a normal decay curve of seeing anything, right? But what's something that stuck with you and that was unusual for any reason?
That's a really good question. A movie, piece of art, something.
And I can probably give you an example. Okay, so here's my random example. So do you remember the series of books called The Animorphs?
I never read those, but yeah, I remember
them. Yeah, it's basically, there's like a sci-fi, like it's a young, sort of more teenage, a bunch of teenagers basically get a power to morph into animal they want. And the books had like these covers where it would be animal, like a human slowly morphing. So it just has like stages of the photos. It's like, you know how like Snapchat has the filter, you can just transform your face. It's like, imagine that in like a thing. And the book itself could flip, like the back corner, it had a little animation for it. One of the actual books called the Elymas Chronicles. So most of them is like, yeah, you know, there's the alien, da da da, they go attack, they fight, da da. This one was about like how this random race, through the series of very tragic events, like basically they all died out, one ended up becoming this deity figure, but he was like penultimately alone in the universe. Yeah. And just trying to invent his own. It was like, literally, you go from like, da-da-da-da-da, everyone's like fighting aliens and there's explosions, to this story of existential dread. And I just wasn't ready. Because like, you know, you book it up as a as an example of just like, you know, like you expect same stuff. Like it's one of the few books where I read. Mm. And why it stuck with me is I remember waking up like at a certain point later, I can't remember, it was immediately after, but it was weeks and weeks later. And I remember waking up with a tear in my eye because I've been thinking about that book and how like how tragic it seemed. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah. Wow.
That's yeah, it was just like it was a piece of art out like that I wasn't prepared for, if it makes sense.
I can definitely relate. Look, I've got two, and one's gonna be really strange. So I almost want to give you two so I don't feel like such a weirdo. anyway. So the first one is, when I was a kid, I really loved Roald Dahl books. And that was, like Matilda and The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. And I remember after reading Matilda, because, you know, she can, you know, move things with her mind and stuff. And I just really believed that. And something I could never let go of. Like, it was something that I constantly thought about, that, oh, if I just, you know, worked hard enough, if I was smart enough, I could do that too. And The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar is a short story that's very similar, where this very rich guy just starts learning how to focus his mind on one point without any distraction, and is also able to do that. And so that framed a lot of how I used to think back in those days, and potentially, you know, made me work pretty hard at stuff. I think, I don't know.
Makes you focus your efforts.
And yeah, exactly. And okay, so this one's the weird one. So I'm really embarrassed even just saying, but I'm gonna say it anyway. So, do you remember when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never heard who she was. You know, she's a Supreme Court justice, and she wasn't actually, interesting story, but she was potentially not that remarkable in her earlier life, but she did so many amazing things for, I think, civil rights and women's rights. And I just randomly, like, I was listening to her on a podcast, and that night I had a dream about her, and I was at her deathbed. And it's just so strange that I'd never even heard about this person. And as she was like, you know, I think she was dying, she goes to me, "I can rest now." And that really stayed with me, because like, she had done so much good that on her deathbed, she didn't care. She was like, "Oh yeah, I'm totally ready. I can rest now." Like, it's like she worked really hard her whole life to try to do good things and do the best that she could, that death was not something to be afraid of. And in the time of COVID and lockdown and everything, man, that was a full on dream. I was like, that's made a really big impression. The fact that I had no idea who this person was, her life after reading about it was quite exceptional. And she was just an ordinary person living a pretty exceptional life. And by doing that, she had, she'd come to a very good place by the end. I thought,
like, as in it made it so that it was her life was like well lived. Is that the sort of?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, her life is well lived. have no reason why I should have, you know, had that dream, but it made it really, it made a really big difference to me.
Fair enough. I mean, totally weird, weirdo, but wow, that was like a, well, that was going to be the last random question, but like, man, that got deep for the last.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Let's get back to the Roald Dahl and the moving things with your mind.
Maybe. Yeah, that seems better.
All right. I think well, that's about, we've gotten to about an hour and we're kind of running out of questions. So we start wrapping it up. Yeah, anything you want to ask, Chandra?
I'm pretty good.
All right. Any sort of things you would like to spread to our huge audience?
Oh, no, I'm just really flattered that you'd want to interview me. And I mean, it's a really nice experience to think about these things and questions, because, you know, normally you just have a chat with your mates, but this is, it's just a really interesting format for answering questions and talking about life. And yeah, and you know, whatever happens with this interview, it doesn't matter too much. It's just that's enjoyable.
Right. Send it to our boss.
Yeah, that's right.
The opinions of the department.
That's right. But yeah, no, that was really enjoyable. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for making the time.
Yeah. Thanks for making the time. As always, we will, like, on YouTube and stuff, like and subscribe and hit the bell. No, actually, don't bother hitting the bell. I hate notifications, so I don't think I should encourage anyone.
Yeah, we shouldn't encourage people to have notifications. But we should encourage people to leave a voicemail.
Yes, dear God, please. Lahir, can you leave a voicemail? We just want one voicemail, just to see what happens if we get a voicemail in the Anchor app.
How do you do that? Tell me, how do I leave a voicemail?
I think it's anchor.fm/randit/message. But the link will be down below. Okay. And links to Lahiri's many channels. Like, let me know what you want us to link. And we'll
link everything. Yeah, everything. I'll put it
all. I actually found out about
all the buttons projects here if you're on YouTube, because I think we can do that.
No, I don't think we have enough subscribers to enable that. But anyway, we'll figure something out. But the thing is, whatchamacallit, yeah, you got to actually, this new project that I didn't know you were doing. So I need your links so I can actually link them.
That's good.
All right. Well, with that, adios. That's it for another episode. Tune in next time. And it'll be either, is it a mini-sode? Well, actually, one of the episodes is going out today. So this will be in about 2 weeks' time. So we'll have something else for you. All right. Bye-byes.
Oh, and do you want me to do it, my own outro for you with my voice and my baritone?
Like, ooh, yes, why not?
Okay, it's time to wrap it up. Thank you very much for listening. This has been the Rand In Podcast with Chandra and Rafi. We'll see you again next time.
Wow, that's what a professional sounds like.
Hey, we should get this
more up our game instead of like having food in the background.
Quality dongles. You should move to... You have low quality dongles. You need to move to Apple, where all the dongles are high quality.
Yeah, I don't want to spend like more for the dongle than I did for the laptop. That's where you are at the moment.
But it's all about dongle life.
Hey, mom and dad, stop fighting. It's all the same nerdy tech shit.
No, it's not. Okay.
Like, dongle this.
That dongle.
Linux.
Yeah, we need somebody else to join in.